You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
And welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz. It's August 25th, 2021. Well, if you ever watch the HG channel and you watch people flipping homes and making tons of money and you think it might be a good idea, well, before you go buying your first wreck, your first fixer-upper, you might want to hear from my next guest, Mike Sowers, who believes that it is possible to get far higher returns investing in commercial real estate. I'm curious to hear what he has to say as well. If you're a real estate investor, I would like to hear from you. Why don't you send me an email to kl@carrielutz.com. Hey, Mike, welcome to the show here. So tell us here, flipping houses, not all it's cranked up to be?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on the show. It's great to be here. And flipping houses is great. I think it's a great first step for many investors. But what I talk about in my book we just released on Amazon last month is that you don't have to go into flipping houses. You can go directly into flipping commercial and bypass decades of transition.
Okay.
Because everybody thinks they got to go directly into flipping houses as kind of their stepping stone, and then they aspire to get into commercial. And I actually figured out you can actually skip all that and go right to the advanced classes.
All right. Well, sign me up here. Let me know. I've done really well in both commercial and in residential, but things have changed a lot in commercial. First, you got to define it, because you could be talking about office buildings, or you could be talking about strip malls, or who knows, post offices. There's a whole bunch. There's a lot of segments, a lot of sectors to commercial real estate. What's your expertise there?
Sure. Yeah, great question. I break commercial real estate into four kind of main categories. You have the multifamily, office, retail, and industrial. And then within those, you kind of have all the different subclasses. But those are kind of the main four food groups, we call them. And within those, there's different niches that I really like. So we're more concerned, Carrie, about only doing deals where we can add significant value to the property by forcing appreciation. Look, it's way more simple than people make it out to be, right? Sometimes I think as humans, we overcomplicate things. So I can just give you the 40,000 foot view of value add investing, whether you're doing in real estate or commercial. And that, to me, is the best long-term risk-adjusted strategy for investing in real estate. And it's only buying properties where you can create significantly more value than it costs you to create that value. And the two key ways that we create value is by renovating properties and leasing them up or filling the vacancies. Now, when you talk about flipping houses, how that's different than flipping commercial is there's two different ways to sell a piece of real estate and really two different ways to value a piece of real estate. One is, what is it going to be worth to somebody who's going to move into it and occupy it as their primary concern? So we call that like an owner user buyer. So when you're buying a house to move into it, as most people do for single family properties, that's like an owner user. So when you're flipping a house, you're making it pretty, and then you're going to sell it to an owner user, right? Somebody who's going to move into it as their house. Mm-hmm. You value those by just looking at what comparable properties like that sold for, and that's how you project the future value of what it's going to be worth. And then you have to deduct your costs and your desired margin to back in how much you can pay for it. What's different is there are certain types of properties that I would value that same way in commercial real estate, but I personally don't target those types of properties. These would be properties that are best suited for a single tenant and generally are smaller in nature. So if you have like a single tenant, 10,000 square foot warehouse property, that is probably going to sell for the highest dollar to somebody who's going to move their little warehouse operation into it. they will generally pay more per square foot than like a financial buyer would, which is the second type of buyer. A financial buyer, on the other hand, they're not buying it for the utility. They're buying it to make a return on their investment. So they would value it based on, I'll pay you a certain multiple of the income it generates for me. And so take the same single family house. Now, instead of selling it as a vacant building to a homeowner, you're putting a tenant in there, you're leasing the space out, and now you're selling that income stream to an investor. It's the same thing in commercial. We target multi-tenant buildings that have a lot of smaller spaces in them because I like dealing with small entrepreneurs. I don't like dealing with huge like corporations. And so I find the smaller ones are easier to fill. There's way more small tenants out there looking. And I like to buy properties that have a lot of different units in them. That way, if any one tenant defaults or even a few of them default, it doesn't really have a dramatic impact on the bottom line versus this kind of strategy of, I'm going to go buy a bunch of McDonald's. And if McDonald's goes out of business, you're probably going bankrupt. That just seems like a very risky strategy to put all your eggs in one basket. So we like buying multi-tenant properties. And then we're only targeting properties that have problems, that the income on it is depressed for some reason. It's either a property problem or people problem or a combination of the both. Maybe there's partnership disputes. Maybe somebody passed away. Maybe they're going into foreclosure. Maybe the underlying tenant's not paying them. Maybe they're just a bad property manager. They don't know how to lease properties properly. Whatever the reasons are, and there's tons of them, we only focus on properties where we can increase that underlying income stream and then kind of de-risk the property to increase the multiple that somebody's willing to pay for that income stream. And so you can do that in residential or commercial, and that's the value-add investing strategy. So when you talk about like, hey, how do you do this and mitigate the risk? I think it starts with having a good strategy. And then it ends with having a good system to implement that strategy.
Okay. So where are these properties mostly? Do you buy them close to home, or are they all over the place? And what types of socioeconomic neighborhoods are we talking about?
Sure. We're primarily right now focused on suburban office in the kind of 10,000 to 100,000 square foot buildings. And mostly in suburban areas. We think that the suburban office sector, it has a much higher perceived risk than real risk. The perceived risk is what you're seeing in the media and what everybody's kind of mindset is, that office is dead, everybody's moving out of offices. But we're actually seeing the complete opposite happen in the real world. We own several suburban office buildings, and we're signing leases left and right. We just closed on one July 1st, and we've signed 5 leases on that particular building already. So we're seeing this kind of huge flow from people that are coming out of the downtown office corridor into the suburban smaller offices, and they're downsizing and they're way more rate conscious. So instead of paying $50 a square foot for the nice waterfall and all the glass partitions, they want $15 a square foot and they only want a third of the space. And I can offer that in one of these suburban office buildings, but they still want it nice and pretty. So we go on carpet and paint, update the bathrooms, make a nice conference room with a cool smart board, and just do some basic stuff. No different than remodeling a house to flip it to a homeowner. We're remodeling a building to lease it to a small tenant. That's it.
So you mentioned doing the conference room, the smart board and all that. Are you furnishing these offices? Are they furnished mostly or unfurnished?
Good question. Most of the offices themselves would be unfurnished, but we do furnish amenity rooms. So like a conference room or seminar room or break rooms, things like that. We'll also furnish common areas like lobbies and corridors. So suburban office is a big one. I really like apartments as well. They just tend to be harder to find those deals because they're what everybody's going after, right? Most people who are flipping houses try and go after apartments. So you really have to dig a lot deeper to get deals at the price you need to have them work. And the other thing is you're buying an income stream for such a bigger multiple that it's harder to make the underlying economics work. So I think from a demand standpoint, apartments feel less risky because everybody thinks that demand for apartments is never going to go away. But from an economic risk standpoint, they actually pose a much higher risk because, like, to buy a $100,000 income stream on an apartment, I might have to pay $2 million and go get a $1.5 million loan. But to buy that same income stream on a suburban office, I might only have to pay $1 million and go get a $750,000 loan. So not only do I have to raise half the equity capital, I have to take out half the debt, which means that I can absorb much higher vacancy in the building and still make my mortgage payment versus on the apartment.
Makes sense. So you're not concerned about this whole working from home thing, that that there's no need for office space anymore.
Yeah, that's what I'm really trying to dive into, is that whole sentiment that COVID created, that mm-hmm. like office is dead, everybody's working from home. It's like, yeah, there are some of those shifts, but they're not as extreme as people think they are. And if you really carve out, there's opportunities there to make way more money in suburban office right now because of those risks. So instead of getting out of office because those risks are present, I'm actually buying more office at much, much lower price per square foot and still renting them out. Like, just, I'll give you an example. Okay. I can buy office in the Twin Cities Metro here for like $50 a square foot and rent them out for like $15 a square foot. Okay. Mm-hmm. On apartments, we're going to pay like $200 a square foot and we're getting around $20 a square foot for rent. So you're only seeing like a little bit more in rent, but you're paying four times the price per square foot. So I'm sure you can imagine the way that trickles down to return on investment is significant. So yeah, maybe I would underwrite a deal last year on office that I was going to have 20% vacancy, and now I'm underwriting it to have 35% vacancy, but I still make a lot more money at 35% on that office building than I do on an apartment at 10% vacancy.
What kind of incentives do you use to fill the space?
Free rent. We will remodel their unit to customize it for their space. But free rent is the biggest one. People love free rent on the front end.
How much free rent do you have to give and how long a lease?
Normally, I give a month's free rent per year of lease. Mm-hmm. So you want to do a three-year deal, I give it 3 months free.
Okay, that makes sense. And how elaborate do your build outs get?
That really depends. Most of our suburban office, again, we're targeting small business owners. Okay, so, you know, 1,000 square foot spaces, imagine. Okay, so most of the people we're renting to got an office space because they didn't want to work from home for a variety of reasons to begin with. Normally, it's just them by themselves, or maybe they'll have a couple of people working on their team. It's mm-hmm. super awkward having employees come to your house. Yeah. And it's hard to be really productive when you're working at home, as many people found out in COVID. So people that were in the corporate environment that started working from home, they loved it because they were like, wow, I don't have to go to the office. I love working from home. But entrepreneurs who were already working from an office because they were choosing to do so, most of them continued to work from their office. And that's really the second segment is the ones we're going after. We're not going after big corporations. We're going after small entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. How big is your average office?
1,000 square feet.
1,000 square feet. So in a 50,000 square foot building, how many offices would that translate into?
Like 40 to 50 offices.
Yeah. Interesting.
Office suites. And then each suite would have, you know, 1, 2, 3 offices, maybe a common area, something like that.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yep. Yeah. Well, it makes sense. Well, somebody has been working from his home for the past 9 years, I thought about offices because, like you say, employees and such coming to your home, a little different. But, it's still, you got to take money out of your pocket. So what's the average rent on a 1,000 square foot property? You're getting $15 a foot, you said, somewhere in that range.
Yeah, that's per year. So $1,200 a month, something like that.
And that's and then you got tax escalators built in and operating cost escalations and all that stuff.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So typical commercial lease, office lease. What about retail? Because we all hear that retail is dying. Have you gotten into any strip malls or things like that?
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Today's show is brought to you by GR Silver Mining, ticker symbol TSX, GRSL, OTC, GRSLF, and their website at grsilvermining.com. The company is extremely well capitalized, currently has a resource of 40 million ounces of silver, and is looking to triple that number in just the next year alone. Its management team is first rate, headed up by Marcio Fonseca, a geologist with vast experience in mining operations and the financial sector as well. With all this going for it, and with silver trading over $25 the ounce, there's no telling how high GR Silver Mining will go. So go to grsilvermining.com to stay up to date on the latest developments and get on their notification list today.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
So I personally am not a huge fan of retail because it feels so speculative in nature. It's, you know, everything in this business, to make money flipping houses or commercial real estate, you need to get really, really good at two things. If you can get really, really good at these two things, you can make multiple seven figures every year doing investing in real estate pretty consistently with very little risk. The two things are being able to accurately predict the future value of the property once you fix it up and fill the vacancies. And the second thing is estimating the costs to do that. So knowing how much a renovation item is going to cost you, knowing how much you can lease spaces for and what the leasing commissions are going to be, those are the two hugest factors in figuring out your cost to stabilize the building. And then knowing what it's going to be worth. Are you going to try and sell this thing to an owner user? If you're doing that, you need to run comparable sales for what other vacant buildings sold per square foot and figure that out versus figuring out is if this is a multi-tenant building, if you got an office building with 50 suites in it, you're not going to sell it to one person who's buying the building to put their business in there, right? You're going to be selling it to an investor who's buying it to make a return on their investment. They're going to figure out what income does it generate and what multiple of that income am I willing to pay for it based on the risk of the project. So there's two sides of that valuation. It's figuring out the future value, but then it's also figuring out your cost to get it to that value. And once you know those, then you can really confidently figure out your break-even purchase price. If I think the building's worth $5 million when it's all said and done, and it's going to cost me $1 million to get it there, my break-even price is $4 million. If I want to make $1 million on it, I know I can pay $3 million. Mm-hmm. And it's as simple. That's how they do it when they're flipping houses. They'll be like, well, you know, what did the three pretty houses like it sell for in the area, you know, fully remodeled? Let's say they figure out it's worth $300,000 all fixed up, and then it's going to take me $50,000 to get it fixed up. My break-even price is $250,000, and I want to make $100,000 so I can pay $150,000 for it. So then what you figure out is you get into it, and now if you blow it, like your remodeling costs go way over budget, and then you don't sell it for as much as you thought, then that's a good learning lesson for you to use, and you kind of learn through iterative process. So on your first deal, you're just, you know, you're doing your best, but as you do more and more deals, you get better and better at being able to analyze those things. But I always tell people, look, if you want to get in this game, focus on building skill in those two areas, because those are the two most important areas for analyzing a deal. And if you screw those things up at the outset, you're just always chasing your tail.
Right. I gotcha. You take on partners in your deals, or is it just you?
Yeah, I take on partners. You know, there's really two ways to invest. There's active investing. That's the people who do all the work. The work I break into seven steps. I call it the seven steps to freedom in my book, Commercial Real Estate Investing. I found a way to make all the steps start with an F. But I'll list those off for you. So here's what the work is. This is what the active partner does. We're the active partner in all of our partnerships. You got to go find the deal, figure out what to pay for it, fund it using equity partners. That's where the other person comes in. Then you got to fix it up, fill the vacancies, stabilize the financials, and then free up your capital by either selling the property or refinancing it. So that's what the active partner does. The passive partner only gets involved basically with the funding piece of that, step three, and they put up the cash. And in exchange for getting a fully passive return, they give some of the upside to the active partner. So it's a symbiotic relationship. Passive investors are high net worth individuals or high income earning individuals, people who have cash, they want to get put to work, and they don't want to put 100% of their cash into the stock market. very few people actually even know this. And especially like call your financial advisor and be like, hey, I'm considering investing into a private partnership on a real estate deal. What do you think? And see what they say. Because I would venture to say, based on my experience, that less than 1% of them are going to recommend it. Why? Because they want to be managing the money because they get their cut on it. And two, because they're never going to recommend something that they don't understand. And very few financial advisors understand alternative investments. I mean, call them and ask them if you want to invest in gold. It's all kind of the same stuff. They'll push you towards investing in a gold ETF or something like that, or investing in a REIT in the stock market so that they can keep their hand on the money. But what people don't realize is that there are people like me across the country that do private partnerships that nobody ever hears about, that if you get the opportunity to sit in those rooms and invest in these deals and give a small chunk of that to the deal sponsor for doing the work, you can get much, much better returns for the same, if not less risk, because you don't have 14 layers of money managers between you and the person actually implementing the business plan.
Very true. Hey, how long you been doing this for, Mike?
I started in 2005. And since then, I've done a little over 150 million in transactions and remodeled over 1,000 properties.
Hey, what's your least successful endeavor?
I bought a junior lien on a property, and it turned out it was actually in third position. And I didn't think the second position was going to redeem, and they did. And so we lost $37,000.
All right. Well, hey, nothing ventured, nothing gained. But as far as deals that you actually went through with, that you consummated and actually implemented your plan, what's the worst return you got on one of them?
Well, we measure return in three ways. Are we talking internal rate of return, cash on cash, or equity multiple?
Well, just one that disappointed you on all three of the above.
I think the worst yield that I've ever got at the project level was like 22% mm-hmm. annualized.
And then when you sold it, so that's the thing, you could have a lower cash flow than you expect, and then you could sell it at the right time, and it kind of bails out your mistake, right?
Yeah. So what would be a typical deal? So like we have a fund that we raise capital in, and right now, and this is, I'm not trying to solicit people to come into our fund. I just want to be clear on that. But just to give you an idea, the fund pays like 10 to 12% annual cash on cash. So if you put in 100,000, you get 10 to 12 grand a year. And then on the back end, you would get roughly a 50 to 70% increase on the back end. So you get like 150 to 170 grand back. And it's usually like a three to five year deal.
Okay. So talk to me about tax advantages here.
Tax advantages are tremendous. There's a little part of the tax code that allows you to segregate the components of the building into different buckets.
Section 179, cost segregation study.
Yep. So we if we're buying a property with the intent to hold it long term for cash flow, which generally is our primary concern for buying properties, unless it's a building that's best suited to exit right away to an owner user. But if it's like a multi-tenant building, then we'll buy it with the intent to hold it for long term cash flow. And we cost segregate those. You obviously know about them, but just for the listeners, basically, you're taking an engineer and a CPA and having them both sign off on a report that segregates the components of the building into different buckets and then puts a value on each bucket. Now, the beauty of it is you can write off the 5, 7, and 15-year property buckets all in the first year, which translates to normally like 30 to 40% of the purchase price. So if I buy a building for like $1 million, till
2023, when that's set to expire, but it's still going to be a good deal even when it does. But yeah, I got you. So you write off 40% year one. That is a passive loss. Your investors can take it against passive income, thereby shielding a lot of their profits that they wouldn't otherwise. And since you're not selling it, you're not worrying about recapture of depreciation. You doing Section 1031 swaps or what?
Yep. Whenever we exit out of a building, we generally would do a 1031 into another property. Actually, we also allow 721s into our fund, which allows people to contribute their property in exchange for membership units in the fund. It's one of the very few ways that somebody can increase their diversification and exchange direct ownership in a property for a financial interest. There's also a way to do it through a DST, but there you're exchanging only into ownership in a specific property. Whereas doing a 721 into a fund, you can go from owning one property. So let's say you're 80 years old, you own one property, you're sick and tired of managing it, but you love all the benefits of the depreciation, the cash flow, and all the other great things that come along with real estate. Plus, you don't want to ever pay the taxes because you want to pass away, go meet your creator, and have your kids get a step up in basis so that nobody ever pays the taxes. So what you do is you contribute your property to our fund through a 721 exchange. You give up a little bit of the upside, but now instead of owning 100% of one property, you might own 1% of 100 properties because of your units in that fund. And then the benefit to you is you just hang on to those units. Your kids inherit those units when you pass away, and they get a step up in basis that's attached to your specific units. And then they can liquidate to sell the units to the partners after that at fair market value.
Interesting. All right. There's a lot of potential angles here. We appreciate you coming on. If people want to find out more about you, buy your book, Mike, where do you go?
Two things. If you just want to have a conversation with me, discoverycallwithmike.com. If you want to get a copy of my book, you can buy it on Amazon, or I'll give you a free PDF. It doesn't cost me anything, and I just want to bless your life. You can get that at commercialinvestingbook.com, free PDF of the book.
All right. Excellent. Hey, it's really enlightening here. Different take on real estate. We hear a lot of people flipping residential, but it sounds like there's a lot less competition in commercial as well. If you got a question for Mike, just send an email to me, kl@carrylutz.com. Make sure you sign up for a free newsletter. Mike, been a pleasure. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks so much, Carrie. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.